All right, this is Karen Brewster, and today is October 8th, 2025. And I'm here in Juneau, Alaska, and we are interviewing Norman, or Norm, Cohen. I'm here with Jim Fall, also helping with the interview. And then Bill Schneider is on the phone, listening in from Fairbanks. And this is for the Subsistence Research Legacy Project. So thank you, Norm, for spending time with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Before we get into the nitty-gritty topics on subsistence, tell me a little bit about your background, where you're from, education, how you came to Alaska.
From Eastern Connecticut, small town. Graduated from Dartmouth College in 1972. Went to the University of Connecticut School of Law, 72 to 75. Got home from studying for the Connecticut Bar, and my roommate had applied to become a VISTA volunteer, and they said he could go to Alaska. He said, I really want to go to Arkansas. What he's thinking. And I said, can I go? And 4 hours later, I had applied, been accepted, and decided to come. So it was a four-hour decision, and I ended up in Anchorage with he came, and he went to Fairbanks, and I went to Bethel. So that's my short background of how I got to where I started involved in this stuff. Was by Dan Boyette. Do you ever know Dan Boyette?
No.
Guy lives in Anchorage. He was a VISTA volunteer in Juneau and at Bethel, and he said that Bethel had the best city basketball league in the state. So I said, good, I'll go to Bethel, and eventually became commissioner of basketball out there for a couple of years, and lived there off and on between 75 and 83, and then worked out there off and on until about 2002. And I haven't been back since, which is a problem. Anyways, that's how I got here and how I got to Bethel.
Uh-huh. And what did you do as a VISTA volunteer in Bethel?
Well, I was with Alaska Legal Services, and my supervisor with Don Mitchell, and it was he and I at the time, and then a guy named Dan Branch and Craig McMahon showed up, both of whom passed away. I took over a couple of people's caseload. The first thing I had was Macoria guiding for muskox. And they had just, there was an attempt being made to try to get the guide board at the time, which I don't believe exists anymore, to allow people in Macoria to guide people for muskox hunting, which was actually a pretty forward-looking on their behalf. But it all had to do with marine mammals at the same time. But in any event, they made a deal to allow Macoric people to be transporters of sorts, so that because they weren't qualified as professional guides, but they wanted the economic benefit of that hunt to stay in the village. And as far as I know, it could still be going on today exactly the same way as it was worked out in 75. So that was September 75, about 3 weeks, maybe October 75, because the World Series was going on. I'm trying to follow the Red Sox from Macoria with no electricity. The electricity was out the entire time I was there. Staying at Larson King's house. So I have these memories. But any event, that worked out. And so that's how I got involved. So that was the first thing. And then this other guy, Harold Spark, who I mentioned at lunch, roundabout got to Bethel and set up a group called Nunum Klutsti, Protectors of the Land. And it represented all 56 villages, AVCP at the time was Yuktuk Vista, run by a guy named Harold Napoleon. And Harold set up this group to look out for what would now be called environmental conservation issues. It really centered around two things, hunting and fishing, and any resource development that would go on in the area, which, being out there with there's not many resources, has never really been that big a issue, but there was stuff offshore and some mining issues going on at the time. And Calista was involved with something with Shell, and that was a pretty controversial thing before I got there. So anyways, Harold shows up and he's looking for somebody to help him out on, and he throws down the Federal Register dealing with the Marine Mammal Protection Act that the state was trying to regain management. Because when it was passed in 72, the assumption was that the state would regain management if they followed along with the federal rules. Similar to, as I said at lunch again, how EPA rules, you can take them or the feds can be in charge, whichever. So I looked at it and decided that I didn't think that they could do what they wanted to do because they had to to abrogate the native exemption, which allows people to hunt and fish if they're Alaska Natives who live along the coast. In fact, there was a story about that in the news last night about the city council of Petersburg wants to expand the ability of people to hunt sea otters because they eat all the crab. And they had this whole discussion about native only and about that it has to be a customary and traditional use. The Fish and Wildlife Service has prohibited people from doing anything that people didn't do with sea otters, and nobody did anything with sea otters anyway, so there's no real customary and traditional use of that for handicrafts or whatever, so people don't go hunt them, except in a very minimal way, and that means that sea otters get to do what they want. So this is still an ongoing issue even now, 50 years later.
When you say abrogate the native exemption, do you mean expand the eligibility to hunt marine mammals to non-natives?
No, it was to
just not allow them to hunt at all.
No, it was to allow them to hunt under state regulation.
Okay.
But it was to regulate native use, not to, it wasn't even, I don't think at the time, to allow non-natives to hunt. I think there was, because I think they thought that guides would be able to go in back into business, but I don't remember that specifically. But the part that was the key thing was to have the state regulate native use, which was not provided for in the federal law.
Okay.
So this is now 1976. And then D2 was kicking up. And I at this point of now, out of legal services, I was sort of in private practice. Sort of part of it worked for the DA's office in Bethel as something to do, but mainly was hanging out with Newton Klutzke. And then the whole Anilka stuff was going back east. A rural cap hired Don Mitchell to be their lobbyist to work on subsistence there, and they came up with this plan. Now, as the plan, which became Title VIII, had its origins in the Western Arctic caribou herd crash and the system that Bob Hinman created that the board adopted that was overturned by the court, but sort of recognized the importance of the resource for local users compared to everybody else and try to put in a system to allow that to happen. So that became the basis for how Title VIII was put together. And I won't go into the dinner at my house. That's sort of irrelevant to this. So Congress now is almost ready to pass ANILCA, which, it's all, ANILCA gets passed in 78, in 80.
80.
80, right before the end of the Carter administration. when Ted Stevens said, let's do this, even though Reagan's coming in and they didn't have to do it. They could have fought it out and gotten a better deal from the non-conservation side of the world at that point. But for whatever reason, he said, enough is enough. We'll just do this. I don't know why. But 2 years earlier, when they were ready to pass it, because then Carter put in the monuments, they said, if the state wants to retain management of fish and game, for completely maintain it, they would have to pass a law that was consistent with the wording of Title VIII at the time. So
that was draft Title VIII.
Draft Title VIII.
This is 78.
So, because we thought it was going to pass then, but then it fell apart, and I forget why. So I was sent down by Harold Spark, who was running Newnham Clutesty, go to Juneau and work on this, putting it to state law. So I came down, and George Irvin came down from Rural Cap, and David Hoffman chaired the thing, and this was in Representative Anderson's office, Nels Anderson.
And Hoffman was a staff person to Nels Anderson.
Yes. And so I had two issues on my agenda. One was to make sure that people could share subsistence caught fish and game, and that was because the Fish and Wildlife Protection, every spring when first king salmon came, they were, Fish and Wildlife Protection would go on the radio in Bethel and say, you can go out and fish, but you can't share what you catch. And I remember they're like, what? And of course, sharing your first catch is sort of a time-honored tradition. And the other thing was Francis Dementia up in Holy Cross would be selling salmon strips, dried salmon, in the grocery store there in Hooper Bay, in Holy Cross, but there was no provision for those kinds of sales. And that then became the customary trade provision of ANILCA, of Title VIII, and the state, but first it was the state law. So the state law, there were those two provisions were the basic changes from the structure that was created by, in Congress, at that stage of the process. When the state subsistence, and when the state subsistence law passed, then those provisions got changed in ANILCA to mirror the state language. So those were my issues, and you know, but the other issues were George Irvin's, and he came down from Anchorage, and his all he was about was creating a subsistence research division. And I'm going, wow, I didn't really think that that was really, that's, you know, I'm thinking like a lawyer, not thinking like a some, you know, this policy kind of wonk kind of deal, and thinking the long term, how this is all going to work. I didn't know, understand fish and game that well. I'd just been around a couple of years. And George's position was, this is what needs to be in the bill. And so he worked, I think, with David. There were some other people in the room. I don't remember who they were. And they drafted up the language that then became the division section, as it turned out, became the what's in the statute at the time when it was passed. So
that was for the state subsistence law.
And there's never been a subsistence division provision in federal law. This was totally a state thing added on at the time, you know. And in those days, the Bush caucus was a very powerful part of the legislature. In fact, they ran things for many years in the late 70s until the 80s. Until the census reapportionment in after 80, because they closed ADAC, 6,000 people left the district, and that then changed everything, and the power went to Anchorage.
And remind me who David Hoffman and George Irwin worked for?
George Irwin worked for Rural Cap. David Hoffman worked for Nels Anderson.
Okay, as a staff
person. As staff person. And then he went on to he was Commissioner of Commerce, and he started that's the name of that group at ASRC's Community Development Bank, I forget. I don't know why. I can't remember it. Anyways, and I don't know where David is now.
I just want to interrupt something. I know this is something unconscious, but you keep tapping the table and play. And I know. So
yeah.
Thank you. You
no problem. My wife's doing all that. I'm hitting things.
You can just move back from the table and hit something else.
Right. So that's what I remember.
Yeah.
And that's totally. That's all. You know, those are the highlights that I remember.
Do you remember what justification George Irwin gave for needing the program?
I thought it was like, I wasn't going to say anything, but I didn't really, it wasn't on my radar as even that was something that was needed, and turned out to be, he was right. And I appreciated that after time, but it didn't dawn on me at the time that this was something that was needed.
And in that state law, even in the first draft of it that I've looked at, it lists duties of the division of subsistence, mm-hmm. what the division was supposed to do, which largely, not entirely, still exists. Did you remember any discussion about those? Did he come up with those?
I think we were sort of split off into groups to work on parts of it, and he was off with somebody doing this, and I was not in. This is, as I said, 48 years ago.
Yeah, right.
I don't really remember exactly, but I don't think I had any role other than just when he's,
when he first
that he did this. I go, wow.
So he first brought it up.
Yeah.
And he, of course, has passed, so we can't ask him anymore. Do you know, though, Norm, what was George Irwin's background that might have led him to think that such an organization was needed?
I have no idea.
He was a lawyer, though?
No, he was a guy.
From where?
He was a Princeton guy, and I'm not sure, but it was all sort of East Coast, I think it was East Coast, that kind of background.
But he worked for RuralCap doing what?
He was the deputy director of RuralCap under Phil Smith.
Okay, so maybe Phil Smith had some?
No, I think this was totally George. I don't think Phil, Phil.
Another guy who's passed. So
yes,
they all have, yes.
Yeah.
Going back a little bit when we were talking at lunchtime, you did mention a hearing that took place in Bethel,
right,
that Congressman
Seiberling.
Right. Could you talk a little bit about that? Because I think that played a bit of a role in this whole narrative.
Yeah, so, I will skip that, but I'll go back to it. So, because I'm not sure. So, before there was talk in D.C., which I wasn't involved with, that on how to deal with subsistence, because since the Alaska Organic Act in 1880 something or other, there's always been a provision in federal law that said we'll deal with this eventually.
Yeah. And keep pushing it down the road.
We'll push it down the road, but they said it each time. It wasn't like they forgot about it. And then, of course, in the Marine Mineral Protection Act in 1972 and the Endangered Species Act in 1973, they actually did put some provisions in there for how to deal with subsistence uses, which were, the first time that I guess that had ever been done. I don't know, maybe. So this is now on the radar. And of course, there was a lot of angst in rural Alaska about rules that affected how people were able to compete against other user groups. So this, it's all bubbling up here. So Seiberling comes for a field hearing on the bill, which was held in Bethel, and Harold Spark organized, and I was actually working for the DA at the time. I took off a few days of work just to participate in that meeting at the high school in Bethel. 4 days on what to do about the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta in D2. And after 4 days, they concluded that they wanted the Fish and Wildlife Service to have a refuge there rather than be under BLM, because nobody liked BLM at the time.
And those were the only two choices.
Yeah, there wasn't going to be any parks out there. And so, yeah, that's it.
No trees, so no
forest. No forest, no trees, no anything. So you had two choices, and they picked the Fish and Wildlife Service. And I assume mostly over time they've been happy with that. I don't know. And at during that time, so the Interior Department brought Buff Bolin up, who was Under Secretary or Assistant Secretary for Fish Wild and Fish Wildlife and whatever in the Interior Department. And so he came over to dinner, Don Mitchell, Dan Hensley, and myself. And it's that point that Don went through what he thought was the solution, which was basically going back to Bob Hinman's plan for the Western Arctic, that would work. Because there had been discussions in DC as whether this was going to be a native priority or native only, or it was going to be rural. And at some point, somebody made the decision that it was going to be rural and not going to be native. And who made that decision? And I knew it at the time, but I can't remember who made that decision. So that was when the idea of how to do this was broached with Interior, and that's that little piece of the story.
And that became part of Title VIII, that procedure.
Yeah.
That was modeled after the Western Arctic caribou herd.
Exactly.
Procedure that the court, that the state court had,
right,
had
trouble
nixed.
With. Yeah,
had, yeah.
So what was that procedure? Do you remember what
it was? A priority for rural residents, okay. Yeah, local residents, more local than other residents.
Yeah, wasn't that the one that was the Fairbanks folks?
Tanana Valley, yeah. Sportsman Association sued over it. Yes,
right, and they won, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah, but that.
I think you should back up, Norm, and get us back to Juneau and the subsistence section and its establishment before we get to the challenge in court.
Well, the problem is that when, as far as I've gotten in the story, I went back to Bethel, and the DC people came in to try to clinch the deal to get this done, because the legislature was under a lot of pressure to pass this thing, because then they would not lose management over, or at least a portion of, Fish and Game that, you know, they quote unquote had worked so hard to obtain its statehood. And so I was out of it then. I went back to Bethel, and I was not engaged in the actual passage of it by the legislature.
In 78.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you're not familiar with the shift that happened, because the draft law as was submitted by Nels Anderson had a division of subsistence. And then when the law was finally passed, it was a subsistence section.
And I, no participation in that at all.
Do you recall any discussions?
I don't remember anything about it.
What is your...
I have no even speculation other than people trying to do, you know, I mean, there were a lot of legislators of both parties who were not particularly enamored with subsistence. There's a Fairbanks Democrat representative who was, you know, on the other side of this thing, as an example. Mm-hmm. So you didn't have that many friends, and the rural guys and the other mainstream Democrats, the Sunshine Boys at the time, the end of their era, they were not necessarily friendly either. So there was this, you know, I don't know the dynamics that went on to get the thing actually passed.
Do you think it might have actually been a compromise then?
To
move the program from a division to a section to kind of...
get some more votes or to...
Yeah.
Assuage somebody, I'm sure, but I have no idea.
Okay.
It wasn't around.
Okay. And who might, do you think?
Don was there. Yeah. Don Mitchell was there. Nels Anderson, he's still around?
I don't know. I was just going to ask you.
I thought he was still alive. I don't know. Is John Sackett still around?
No.
And Frank Ferguson died. Jack Fuller, probably from Nome, he's probably dead. So
they were all the legislators who were
and they were all pretty powerful too, weren't they? That was the Bush caucus, and Sackett certainly was, and Ferguson.
Right, and again, this is before Al Adams, and it was Ferguson, Sackett, and Homan, and were the guys who had the power in those days.
Yeah.
And they were pushing for passage of the bill.
Yeah. I mean, they were listening to AFN, and by this time AFN had gotten on board, and then they hired Don from RollCap, and so they were in it big time then, but it was not right at the beginning, and that RollCap was the one who really got things going back east.
And do you know why AFN wasn't on board at the beginning?
It just wasn't on their radar. They were, trying to get these corporations to work, and that was their primary focus at the time, I think. But, it's a long history.
I want to follow up on this a little bit. Before we do that, when we were talking at lunch, you also mentioned that technically the 1978 state subsistence law wasn't the first statute that addressed subsistence, and there was an earlier one.
Right. Jimmy Huntington passed a bill passed, I think it was 74 before I showed up, and it was the ability to go to the boards to create subsistence hunting areas, and they would be identified as a piece of land, and we put a proposal into the boards to create a subsistence hunting area for moose in Unit 18, which is the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, which doesn't necessarily have a whole lot of moose in it. But it didn't pass.
Yeah, I don't think they ever created one of those units under that law.
Right.
So the boards were not receptive to this idea of having a subsistence hunting area?
No. I would say probably not.
Do you know why? What their arguments were?
Oh, no, I don't remember. I mean, I think they're pretty obvious that, who else goes out there? Why would we need to do this? There's not enough moose to worry about, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But it's, most of the moose out there, some up in the Andreevsky, and then the others are in, I think, Unit 21 over above.
Well, since then, moose have really moved into Unit 18.
Have they?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's a lot more now than there used to be.
And that's sort of amazing, because there are a lot more people than there used to be, too. And you would think that would mean fewer moose, because the more would get... I don't understand how this all works, because so I never went to biology. I never was a biologist, so that's why I was at Fishing Game for all those years. Yes.
And getting back... Go ahead, Bill.
Wondering if you were conscious at that time of how this subsistence section was received within Fish and Game, and what was going on there in terms of that dynamic?
I have a feeling about it. I showed up and started working at Fish and Game in 83, and at that point it was not very well received or liked. So I can't, so we're now back in 78, 79 when it all got started. And all I remember is I really thought that Tom Lawner did a great job of setting it up. Taking something from nothing and creating a whole program and knowing what you were doing, I was really impressed by the whole thing, as I recall. But I know that it was resented by people, and that took a long, long time, if it's even now today, past that. I don't know. I assume we're past that, but I don't know. Since I retired, I know nothing about what's going on in any of this stuff. So
fortunately, we're asking you about what happened before,
way before I retired,
not what's happening now. So
yeah.
So did you attend any of those post state subsistence law board of game or board of fish or joint board meetings?
Oh,
for
yeah.
Any issue?
I
you
mean,
did?
I, you know, I attended more board of game and fish meetings than anybody else for about a 5, 6, 7 year period. I was there all the time, and maybe a shorter period, but I was there all the time. I went to local fish and game advisory committee meetings in Marshall and Mountain Village and Monarch, Luckanuck, all, you know, mostly lower Yukon as opposed to the Kuskokwim or the coast for whatever reason. Yeah, I mean, there was totally antagonism by the powers that be, whether it be fish and game people or the board, you know, and until Sheffield came in 82, and then he hired Sarah Scanlon and from Hoona, what's her name there?
I think of Brenda Johnson.
Brenda Johnson, and Joel Bennett was on, and Van, the wolf guy from Fairbanks. What was his name?
Van Ballenberg.
Van Ballenberg. So, yeah. I mean, you know, there were a few difficult people during those times, and I guess, what's his name was on? Sidney Huntington, because he was on forever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so... And then Jimmy was on but I went to so many meetings. And yeah, there was antagonistic, but you know, we were working just issues that we had proposals mm-hmm. in for, or, you know, and a lot of it was area salmon fishery. That was a big deal. And but there were, you know, out on the Delta, you didn't really have that many board diverse, you know, difficult issues because, you know, most people were hunting seals and mm-hmm. marine mammals that weren't part of this at mm-hmm. all anyways.
So you did witness section and division of subsistence presentations
oh,
and
yeah.
interactions. And.
But I don't really remember very well.
Yeah.
Sorry to yeah. say.
And who were you working for then?
All right, so 77 I left, and then I worked 6 months for the DA's office. Then I was in private practice until 79. 79, I was the head of the subsistence program at Rural Cap, and I did that until 81, till the end of 80. 81, I worked for Tony Vasca in the legislature. After that session, which is 81, what did I do? Oh, I went back to Bethel and I ran Newnham Klutzke because Harold was off getting another master's degree that ended up with the community development quota program out west. That was the genesis of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I then went to Fish and Game.
Yeah, okay, that was 83.
83.
Well, I know, I'm pretty sure I'm right about this, that one fish board issue that you were involved in was the Tionic case.
Right, yes.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. And
yeah, sure. Hmm. I mean, what happened, you know, there was a proposal in to open in 64, there was the closure of the King Salmon Fishery in Cook Inlet. And so now we're in, so that's 64, now we're in 80? That's right. 80?
Yeah, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I'm working at RuralCap, and Don is working at AFN. And there's a proposal for... And I was involved because the Cook Inlet representative on the... We had a subsistence group. What the heck was it called? Anyways, there was this group of... From each region had a representative. The guy from Tyonek was Fred Bismarck.
Yeah.
And I think Fred asked for help in trying to get King Salmon open for Tyonek. And there was a letter in 64 from Jim Reardon, who was the fish biologist in Cook Inlet at the time, that said, as soon as this comes back, please don't go hunt fishing anymore. This is a very bad situation, but as soon as it's opened up again, you'll be able to go fishing. And the answer was no when the time came. So we sued on behalf of them, and I think it was Vic, what the heck was the name of that judge who then had to quit because he had...
Carlson.
Vic Carlson. He was the judge, I believe. And, we moved for summary judgment or whatever and got it based upon the fact that the law said that if there's a subsistence use, it deserves a priority. And here, there's not only no priority, but no access at all. And so... won the case, and then they were then allocated some number of fish for the use of Tyonek. And that was really the first case that tested the law.
And it happened pretty fast then, the litigation. There was a board meeting, and it was turned down. You put in for summary judgment and got it. It sounds like it was almost a slam dunk by the court.
Well, Looking back on it, it was sort of, but you never knew what the judge would do, and who knew, what judge you get. You could have gotten Carl Johnstone, and you could have ended up in a very different situation. But Vic, Carlson was a good judge, and he read the law, I guess, and agreed with us. So yes, Don and I were the co-counsel for Tyonek.
And my understanding is, because this is before I worked for the division, that this was probably one of the first issues that the then subsistence section presented information at a fish board meeting. Mm-hmm. Do you remember much about that?
No, and I don't think we were at the board meeting that I know of. I don't know that we were there.
Oh, okay, so you came in after. Tyonek came to you after?
Yeah, I don't remember, but I could have been there, but I don't remember. Sorry.
Or maybe Don was there.
I doubt he would have been at the board meeting. I don't think we were, but we could have been. All I remember was flying over to Tyonek to tell them they won, and it was sort of a cool.
That must have been fun.
I don't know, was Larry there or Liza? I mean, somebody was over there for the state, and it was like a big sort of like, there's a whole brouhaha, whole hubbub over there. Mm-hmm. So that was sort of exciting.
So just to clarify, when you talked to Fred, was that before or after the fish board meeting?
I think it was after.
So they had been turned down, and he came to you for legal help.
Yeah.
Basically.
Right.
Okay.
For help, and we were lawyers, so we did it.
But the subsistence division presented, they must have been... have done some research.
Well, that's exactly right, and this is not. I was wondering what Norman heard or seen about that, but Alice Stickney, who was an early division employee, she and Paul Cunningham, who was the first, I guess he was called assistant chief or something, they did a report based upon interviews that Alice had done in Tyonek about the uses of king salmon, and that. That was a staff report that was given along with testimony from elders in Tyonek. And my understanding is it didn't go very well.
And I'm sure we used that information in the case to prove the point, but I don't remember.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't have any records of it, so I can't go back and look.
It was interesting what it was like to go back to Tyonek with that success.
Yeah, no, it was a heady, you know, that's why you're still here in Alaska after all these years. You know, you get these at 24 or 5 or 6 or whatever I was at the time. You get these, you know, opportunities you don't get anywhere else. So what the heck, why go somewhere else and be a grunt?
Now I'm losing track whether I asked you about this already, but I'm jumping back. I just wanted to double check on this. In late 1977, before the state law was passed, there was an interim committee on subsistence that was established by the, I think, the legislature with Nels Anderson. As yeah. You were not involved in,
nope.
in that at all.
No.
Because it sounds like some of the ideas that you were talking about that had been developed by David Hoffman and by Irwin must have gone into some of that committee work, because it sounds like that committee wound up drafting the first version of the legislation. But yeah. none of this is ringing a bell.
All I remember is that the Congress put together this draft. That was what was brought back to Alaska, said you got to pass this thing.
And put in the state law.
And that's when mm-hmm. we had this meeting, which was, and mm-hmm. this, like, we were meeting in February, March, whatever it was, and this thing passes that session. So this was a very short period of time. And I had never even, I don't think, had even been to Juneau before being asked to come down for that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe at once or so, but I was just out there doing mm-hmm. my thing in Bethel.
So that meeting with Anderson and Hoffman and Irwin would have been February, March of 78?
No. Yeah.
The bill passed
it's the same, yeah, it was like a couple of weeks before it passed. This whole thing happened in a very short period of time.
Oh.
That's my recollection.
Okay. My guess is that it might have happened sooner, because the draft legislation that I've seen, that I've got somewhere here,
mm-hmm.
which was introduced to the legislature, was January of 1978, and it already had a division of subsistence, and it had those duties in there. So if that's something that George Irwin came up with in this meeting, it must have happened before the legislation was passed.
It could have been.
Was drafted.
It yeah. could have been. I don't.
Maybe yeah. it was the winter of 77.
You know, I mean, the legislature used to meet a long, long, long time before the early 80s when they did the 121-day session. And, I mean, I worked in the legislature 81, and I left the third week in June, and they were still going. You know, so it was it was different than it is now. Mm. But my memory is totally George and this whole thing.
Okay.
And whenever that happened is when it happened. And yeah. maybe somebody else, it was somebody else, and I just missed it. So yeah. I don't remember.
Maybe yeah, my earlier in the year or something.
Yeah. In the sequence, yeah.
Yeah.
The law itself passed, I think, in July of
86.
No. 78. The first law.
July of 78.
Yeah. And then, yeah, that's right. And I think it came into effect like October 1st of 78.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure of those dates.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Okay.
All right. Well, I could be, my whole history could be wrong, and I'm still going to give George credit, though.
No, it sounds plausible to me. It's just, you just wish we could talk to some of these other guys, too, and learn more about it.
Yeah, and how they went from section or division to section.
Back to division.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, well.
But going back then, so the Tioga case was one of the first testings of the work of the subsistence section at that time. Is that correct?
The thing that sticks in my mind is this letter from Reardon, and that's what sticks in my mind. I am sure the other stuff came in, but I don't remember it. And if I had the briefs and stuff and the work that had been done, and look it over again, I'd probably have a better idea. But, you know, I mean, Don's got all of this. He's kept records of everything. Mm-hmm. And so he has boxes full of all of this stuff, which mm-hmm. would be able to give you a better sense of that case.
Where I was going was, were there more cases, Jim, that you would want to ask Norm about that were coming out before the challenge of the division?
Well, yeah. Were you involved in any of the Copper Basin issues?
No.
Because those are the ones, Bill, that also came up. There was the Danny Ewan case where he took a caribou out of season in the Copper Basin. And the game board, of course, had done nothing to implement the subsistence law. And mm-hmm. so that was his basic argument. I don't know who his attorney was, but they said, you know, the law requires subsistence uses to be provided for. You haven't done this. This guy's obviously hunting for subsistence. How can you convict him? And he won that case, and it resulted in the game board adopting some of the first subsistence hunting regulations that were actually labeled subsistence. Yeah, and there might have been another one too, but
I wasn't involved in any of that.
But it sounds like the Tyonek one was the first one to challenge this new 1978 subsistence law.
I think so.
Well, it's sort of just the opposite.
I mean,
the Tyonek case didn't challenge the law. It said implement.
It
said, you know, implement the law. What is it? And clarified what it meant.
Right.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by challenge. Mm-hmm. To say, hey, you're not applying this.
Right.
The Tyonek people wanted something better.
So were you? I'm changing the topic now a little bit. Jumping ahead. What years were you deputy commissioner?
87 to 90.
I think you said 83 before.
No, I was special assistant.
Oh.
83 to 85.
Okay.
And I worked in Katz's office in 85 for 6 months.
Oh.
And then I came back and ran Habitat Division.
Oh, that's 86, right.
85, 86. And then in 87, I moved upstairs to the deputy commissioner.
Until Rozier came in?
Until Clem Tillian came and said, your time is up. He was Fish Czar for Hickel, that second Hickel term. And I said, fine. I didn't expect to be kept on when Hickel won, so.
A lot of people felt the same way. Did you?
Some people stayed on, but not me.
Yeah. Benke didn't. Did you play any role in the development of the 86 law?
No, because I was at Habitat. I was, next door to subsistence people, but it was not my responsibility.
Any observations?
No, I don't even remember. I don't remember it at all. Yeah. I mean, I was in this sort of, I was viewed as the subsistence guy in Fish and Game, as I recall. You know, and of course, without a biology background and stuff, and, you know, clearly a political appointee. So I was in this sort of no man's land over there for most of the time.
Yeah, and so you were working for Collinsworth.
Collinsworth,
yeah.
Really good guy,
mm-hmm.
in my view.
Yeah, and you were gone by the time that the efforts to get back in compliance with federal law post McNeil.
No.
Oh, you were?
Oh, no, I was there at the, it was me. I was the guy who was responsible for Fish and Game's, what Fish and Game did as a result of McDowell.
Oh.
And so the first thing was we called up the Attorney General, Doug Bailey, and asked him to try to get the court to stay it for a while, which they did. And then Molly McCammon and I were charged as the Fish and Game representatives to try to get the legislature to pass this constitutional amendment, which probably would have passed if Cooper really wanted it to happen, but it wasn't a major, he didn't put his best effort into it. So yeah, I was involved in all that.
Okay.
And
For listeners, maybe give a little bit of background on the McDowell decision and what it reflected.
Well, the McDowell decision reflected the Alaska constitutional provision about distinctions among residents or something. Equal access. And, you know, the court, you know, we complained about it, but Matthews, who's made the decision, probably was right, you know, and, you know, whatever, maybe not. But
so the Chief Justice disagreed. Go ahead, Bill.
But tell us what prompted McDowell.
What prompted it? I mean, there was
an issue in the Copper River, right?
No, I don't think so. I mean, there was a group. There was McDowell, there was Hunter Fisher, there was that other...
Dale Bondurant,
and another guy, big guy.
Warren Olson.
And they were just, this was their life, was to try to get rid of subsistence provisions in state law. And I don't know that there was any issue that they didn't care about. I mean, they cared about everything, I think it was just overall, and so they sued over whatever. I don't even remember what the facts were. What were they prevented from doing that they were able to sue over?
They might have actually argued that they couldn't get a subsistence permit for Nalchina caribou. I don't remember either.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I think it was.
Yeah, but it was much broader, like you say, Norm, that they weren't just worried about one opportunity. They wanted the whole thing to go down because they thought it was unfair. It was unequal. Alaskans for Equal Hunting and Fishing Rights was
right.
The,
and then it was Ed Grasso. Is he like deputy commissioner now or something or other?
He was game division. Wildlife division.
He was part of it. And then what's his name from up in Tok?
Dave Kellyhouse.
No. Oh. He was a staffer. For the legislature. What the heck was his name? He was a good singer. He played at the folk festival. Anyways, they had a crowd, and there was no compromise. It was just flat out. So they kept on trying, and eventually were successful with this, and then they couldn't pass a constitutional amendment. Mm-hmm. One vote, as I recall, was the problem, and Cooper didn't threaten anybody, so.
And that constitutional amendment was going to do what?
It was going to change the constitution so that they could make these distinctions.
Between rural and urban?
Yeah.
It was to allow residents as a criteria for eligibility, which is what the McDowell decision said they couldn't use where you live to define whether you were eligible for participation. And the proposed amendment would have allowed that to be done. Yeah, what I had forgotten was that Hickle wasn't elected until November of 1990, and so he didn't become governor until December of 90. So this first effort under Cooper was before Cooper left.
Right.
Yeah, I'd forgotten that.
Yeah, we were up in McAlpine's office beating on him and, you know, trying to get the votes, but we were unsuccessful.
Do you remember whether anything that the Division of Subsistence had done into that?
I don't remember. No. I'm sure.
Whether it was purely a legal fight or whether there was also some data that came into the discussion.
It was politics, you know. And if you got the votes or you don't have the votes, and how do you get the votes? And you weren't going to get them on this issue. You're going to have to get them some other way that, well, I'll give you a new road in your town or something. Nobody was willing to play that game, and it failed.
It was one vote. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty much Robin Taylor, as I recall, from Wrangell, who was the deciding vote, although anybody who voted against it was a deciding vote, but
it failed. One vote.
it failed by one. Yeah. Interesting.
Do you remember the arguments you and Molly were making to try and persuade people to get the votes?
No, I don't remember. You know, I mean, it was, you know, it's the state's going to regain management. You know, I mean, that's sort of the main argument, and you don't want to have this bifurcated system. And you know, and then of course, as soon as the Fed system got in place, Native community was a lot more comfortable working with them than they were people who were there to represent them, basically, as opposed to the state, which was antagonistic. Mm-hmm. So it made perfect sense that over time you lost your constituency to try to change things. I mean, we did try again in the 80s with another special session to do this, and I worked for AFN on that.
In the 90s, this is.
90s, yeah. That again failed.
Yeah.
So were there any, was there a Native role in that effort to get state management? If, well, you said they preferred the federal?
Well, no, in that first time it was total, everybody was on board. Because there was no federal program at that point, so nobody knew what it was going to look like. But the second time around, there had been one in place. And mm-hmm. then there was a whole bunch of new people involved in this from sort of the Native community. There was this, so things got a little muddled at that point, and I can't go and remember it other than it was muddled, and there's still some, and still some hard feelings about it today. Mm-hmm. With the say those people, so it's sort of a long story.
Do you want to?
I'm not going there.
Okay.
Did we skip over the repeal initiative? I can't.
Yes, we did skip it over.
Did you play much of a role in
this
in
is
fighting?
82.
Now we're jumping back to 1982.
Right. In 1982, I was back in Bethel, and so all I remember is we were just trying to get the vote out there.
Okay.
I wasn't involved statewide.
Yeah. As you might recall, one of the issues that, well, there was a fight within the Department of Fish and Game as to whether employees should be allowed to support
right.
the initiative
right.
as employees, as professionals.
Yeah.
And there was a memo developed called we always called it the 35 signatory memo, because
uh-huh.
it alleged that at least 35 employees in the department had signed it, although I don't know anybody that ever saw that list. I don't doubt that it existed. But one of the points that that memo made was that the Division of Subsistence had to go.
Mm-hmm.
Did you?
No, I don't remember it.
Yeah.
I mean, I do remember there was the controversy over that letter, and that Fish and Game people were taking a public position on this, but I don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, this gets into another area that maybe you can talk a little bit about is your observations of how Alaska Native people especially viewed the program.
The
Division of Subsistence program, and did you hear any feedback while in Bethel or at meetings or?
No, I mean, I think that, I don't know. I mean, I guess my impression was that people created relationships and that things were pretty good. You know, I mean, people didn't like talking about their usages and stuff, but, you know, for the most part, you know, I think that there was a good relationship between the Native community and Mary Pete became director for a while, and Hazel Nelson, and, you know, so I think there were plenty of, you know, that why, if you're not going to join something or be the director if your constituencies have a bad feeling about something, that'd be crazy. And so that's the indication I would have.
Mm. But you were living in Bethel when Mary, before she was director, she
yeah.
was a researcher. Elizabeth Andrews was out
yeah.
there.
Yeah,
Bob,
you know,
Wolf was out there.
Oh, Bob was my hero. I mean,
why?
Oh, the Kotlik work. That was laying, you know, groundbreaking information, and Bob was always my hero.
You'll explain that a little bit more.
Well, I thought that his work in Kotlik, which was, I don't even, was he even working for Subsistence or somebody else at the time, that, you know, the super hunter who shares and all that stuff. I mean, that was really good information. You know, you had to have money and you had to have resources to be able to go out there. So, you know, it's sort of written up into your thing a little bit. And, you know, I mean, Bob was the hero and always had him up on a pedestal.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd make fun of him all the time. But
yeah, and he probably did the same thing back to you. So,
yeah, you know, Bob was always nice to me.
Yeah. But just to clarify, I think the research that you're referring to was either his PhD work, he worked under contract to the division before he was actually hired, and it was, I think it, back then it was a BLM program, but it became the Minerals Management Service and then BOEM after that. But it was the work that he did in five or six Yupik places, including Kotlik, that became a technical paper.
Well, yeah, Kotlik sticks in my mind for some reason, since I spent so little time there. But he came, when he went to work for Subsistence in Bethel, he came with a reputation of he was like somebody that, he's a serious dude and does good work and stuff. So I really, that's how we came to the table, and he, you know, he, that's how we left the table.
Mm-hmm.
When he decided to move to San Diego.
Well, in between, he was in Juneau, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, saw him around here. His kids were my age, kids my same age as my kids, so. Mm-hmm.
But you said he was like a hero. How do you think he influenced your work or your life?
Yeah. Well, I just that he, you know, I'm not sure. I think that this whole idea of the, you know, how he described Subsistence, how Subsistence really works, was really important information to know. I mean, it's sort of an interesting thing. So I talked about Harold for a while. So Harold was the thinker about all of this stuff. And Harold's always was a few years ahead of everybody else, thinking things through and having a plan. And his plan was, the first thing you had to do was protect the food source. So you had to make sure that the subsistence was protected and people were able to eat. Then you got to figure out a way of monetizing the surplus. And that's where the CDQ program came along. And so, you know, you're sort of building this system that people will be able to go out, they can eat, and then they can also make some money. And, you know, it was a great... great plan that he came up with, and then he came up with the vehicles to get this done. And he was sort of seriously hero in this whole thing. I mean, when he died, Knowles came out to Bethel to the funeral and made a speech at his funeral. Yeah. I mean, it was
Harold Spark.
Spark, yeah.
And fitting right into that then was Bob's development of the concept of a mixed subsistence cash economy.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right, because that was the whole thing. Oh, you know, people, blah, 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 you know, and then you have to go to the grocery store issue, and, oh, is there a grocery store? Oh, you can go to the grocery. Oh, how are you going to get there? How are you going to afford it? You know, I mean, things didn't turn out the way you thought they were going to. When I first got there, was the Delta would be, everybody was going to leave, they're all going to move to Muldoon. Now... but what keeps it going? Well, it's obviously federal money for the most part keeps things going. I mean, how else? There's no economy out there. It's, you know, tribes get some money, the YKHC gets some money. I mean, people get money, but there's really no economy, and you can't really create one with nothing to sell or make or whatever. Mm-hmm. So what do you do? And you know, and it's grown over the last 50 years as opposed to what we thought was going to happen. Mm-hmm. So who knows? But, you know, a lot of it, you know, it's people's had access to resources. Mm-hmm. I assume people are still hunting and fishing like they've always done.
Yes.
Well, not so much for salmon in some of those places because of the closures, but.
But it sounds so like Harold was your mentor in one way, and then Bob was the mentor, inspiration, sort of the application of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of the at least the that piece that of the subsistence, system. How it works piece, which you know. I didn't live a subsistence way of life, and so I didn't know what was going on, and, you know, I was living in Bethel. And
well, yeah, he really showed other people how it worked.
Yeah.
The people who were making the decisions.
Right, and, you know, once it gets all these reports get written and things get, you know, it takes on a life of its own, and I think that that's, you know, if you didn't do this work, it wouldn't have taken on a life of its own. And subsistence as a concept and as a practice that is accepted, you know, the subsistence division sections, divisions work in documenting this all and making sense of it is really, you know, that's been very important in this whole development of fish and game management in Alaska. Just because, you know, there's all this stuff to back it up. It's not just, well, it's anecdotal, which is the worst when you're making your decisions on anecdotes.
Maybe this is too general a question at this point, but I'll throw it out and we can pass it over or address it. This rural-urban divide and the impact of the Dow decision, how are we living with that today in light of the history that you've just presented? And I'm prompted to ask this question because of your comment about the significance of this tremendous historical record that's been produced by this division section of Fish and Game.
Well, at lunch I asked the question, what's going on now? I have no clue what's going on, especially down here in Southeast, which you're really, it's a whole different world than the rest of the state. And I don't really know what's going on. You know, I mean, there's problems obviously with salmon runs all over the place, and that's created real problems. But I don't really know. It seems, as I was also mentioning earlier, that you don't really know, you don't hear much about this stuff anymore. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, every oil development project got so much publicity and so much controversy, and, you know, and now you don't hear anything, you know, you hear a little bit every so often, but there's not really the kind, you know, what do Alaskans care about anymore? All of the real anti-crowd died. So they're not around. It's a different generation, I think. The fish and game people who were anti are gone. I don't know how they feel these days. I believe probably that they're a lot more accepting of things than they were 50, 40 years ago. I don't even remember what the question was. I went on and on about stuff. But I think that overall it's, you know, mainstreamed the recognition, understanding of what's going on, and it just isn't a big an issue anymore. But that's my guess. I mean, when I was interviewed for the WorldCap job, and Janie Leisk from AFN asked, well, how long do you think this is all going to, why we're going to need this position as a rural cap subsistence program? I said, 18 months. So what did I know? Nothing.
The real answer was forever.
Right? Forever, yeah, I know. Well, we'll get it all wrapped up in 18 months. Yeah, well, not to happen.
It's sort of the big subsistence issues aren't as big anymore. I mean,
the allocation issues do not rise. You don't hear about, maybe that's a better way of putting it. And I don't listen to Alaska News Nightly at all, so I don't know what they cover. But the Daily News doesn't have anything, and Alaska Public Media's website there, their news feed doesn't really have anything. And, you know, there's something that might happen in Angoon that gets some publicity when Al Kukesh went and broke the rules to prove a point. And so you hear about these things every so often, but it's not on my radar anymore.
Right. I was thinking, yeah, there may be individual proposals that go to the boards that have debate, you know, within communities or something, but they haven't risen to sort of the statewide level, is what you're saying.
Right, and I think that the boards are so bad these days, at least that's my impression. Maybe not, but I mean, they just seemed like they're pretty, you know, they've come from a point of view, because if we've had governors for the last, I don't know. I mean, that's the impression I got. Maybe they're okay, but you're just sort of like, why bother with those people?
I think,
and you got the Fed system that's going, so spend your time over there.
The Fish Board and the Game Board, as you know, historically, and this is still true, can be very, very different.
Mm-hmm.
You know, on the Game Board, I think 6 out of the 7 members live along the road system. I think 3 of them are from the Mat-Su and so forth. So it's really an urban-dominated, mm-hmm. guide-dominated entity. The Fish Board is broader, and I think our experience has been that it has been more open.
Mm.
But like I was saying, at lunchtime, it seems to me that the subsistence topics that you see in the paper now have to do with issues of food security and resource depletion, especially caribou and salmon.
Mm-hmm.
Not so much allocation of those resources. We will see a fight, perhaps, and we'll see whether this makes the paper is when the Area M meeting, the AY, the Alaska Peninsula Fish Board meeting, happens early next year, and there are proposals in there, I think, to, this is an old topic, you're smiling, you know about this, but, you know, there are proposals in there to place restrictions on commercial fisheries there for Yukon and Kuskokwim and even Chinook fisheries, interception fisheries. So maybe that'll get some attention, because it will be a subsistence argument.
Right.
It's not necessarily urban-rural, though. It's rural-rural.
Well, it's actually, I learned something along the way about that, and I didn't get it when we were, I mean, we had proposals on Area M several times, and so we went to the mat with the board about it. And what I didn't understand is that because Southeast is all Cape fisheries, all interception fisheries, that's how Southeast works. And the people here believe that that is the absolute best way of running a fishery, because you only take some from, you spread it around. But all of the, you know, and then how do you get Canadian fish? You get them by, you're not in a river, you're not in front of a river, and most of the fish here aren't going up rivers anyways, that, I mean, they're going to Canada some way or another, or down south. And so they put a lot of pressure on the Southeast representatives to vote no on making changes at Area M, because somehow that may affect how the board looks at Cape and intercept fisheries, which is what Southeast is. And Southeast has had traditionally been the strongest part of the Board of Fish had come out of Southeast. So that was sort of like a light bulb went on in my head when this was sort of explained to me as to why we were having such a hard time, because there's hardly any constituents who live down in Area M. I mean, how many people are there? A couple of hundred live down there. And you got 20,000 people or whatever in the Yukon, Kuskokwim, Norton Sound. You know, you got 50, 60,000 people against a couple of hundred. And it's all got to do with how it affects other fisheries in the state, not the Area M fishery, at least. That's my my theory as to why people have had such a hard time trying to make any progress there.
Mm-hmm. So we'll see, you know, Bill, whether there's coverage and how it's...
Who put the proposal?
I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I'm closer to you now than I was before in terms of not paying attention to some of these things, but
Yeah.
But I did hear about that yesterday.
Isn't that part of the subsistence law is when you are allocating, when there's a depletion of a resource and you have to limit who takes what, that subsistence gets limited last?
You know, if
this, so isn't it an allocation issue?
If this was a perfect world, the way it would work and the way it was written would be you take care of all the subsistence needs first.
Right.
If there's any surplus after that, you divvy it up among some other people. And it's really, maybe it works in some limited cases like that, but nobody was ever willing to really go that far as the law allowed them to go, in my view, mm-hmm. that they pulled their punches. Oh, we can live with, you know, whatever deal, this is okay, blah, 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 just because politically to cut these folks off. Now, sure, you know, there's been genetic studies in there, EM, on how many chums go up the Kuskokwim and how much go up the Yukon, and 50% of them go to Russia, okay? What are we going to do? You're going to take us, so we're targeting sockeye, and they don't go up to there. What are you doing? You're going to give those fish back to Russia. We don't need to give those fish to Russia. And it goes down a rat hole, and you don't get out of it. And, you know, that's my recollection of how those arguments go. And sure, yeah.
There's also the inconvenience that the subsistence fisheries are at the end of the line and the commercial fisheries at the beginning mm-hmm. of the line. So
yeah.
In that case, well, I was just thinking
geographically.
Yeah.
I was thinking just in general, you know, all these pro anti subsistence people who are anti subsistence, the subsistence priority only comes into effect when there is a time of shortage.
Well,
like, isn't that
no,
what the law says?
No. Well, the priority, but the law says that if there's a subsistence use, you provide reasonable opportunities for that use. It doesn't have to be, you don't pay attention to subsistence just when there's a shortage.
Okay.
You pay attention to subsistence all the time. And part of the debate then becomes, well, what is a reasonable opportunity? Do you factor in characteristics of the fishery or the hunt as being necessary for providing the subsistence use? That's another topic that Larry could talk about. But no, I don't think it's correct to say that you only pay attention to subsistence when it's a shortage.
You just provide for it. And
yeah.
Yeah, but it's not a perfect world, and that's a good example of where perfection has not been reached.
I'd be interested in, and this is a slightly different subject again, but it connects to this rural-urban thing. I'd be interested in your view on this. Because I did read some of the, I think it was testimony or a submission that Don Mitchell made to Congress regarding Anelka, and it's in an article that Jim Magdance put together.
Yeah.
Don Mitchell consistently uses the phrase rural Alaska Native, and here I'm emphasizing rural. As a priority, as a preference that he would like to have seen, because it didn't become just became rural, but at that point, I've looked at the numbers. I've figured this out. I think something like 80% of Alaska Native people that had Alaska Native heritage lived in what we would consider to be rural areas.
Mm-hmm.
It's now less than half.
Half of the native folk live in rural areas.
Less than half.
Yeah, that makes sense.
That people have moved
right.
into Mat-Su, into Anchorage, and Fairbanks, and
yep.
so forth. And so it does create a potential issue when you think about Anilka. This has happened when the Federal Subsistence Board acts to provide a preference for subsistence when Yukon River fish go down, they prohibit non-rural residents from fishing in
mm-hmm.
those areas under federal rules.
Right.
And most of the people that they're keeping out are relatives of the people who live there, who go back to help their grandparents or their parents or their uncles.
That was discussed.
It was discussed.
Yeah.
Oh, really?
I mean, it was known that that was the situation, and it was you make a choice. And when things are tough, the village people who stick in the village are first in line. And, you know, move back to Chivac if you want to participate. Fine. Nobody's telling you not to do that. But for somebody who's still living in Chivac, it's different than going to Safeway in Anchorage or Cars or whatever.
But what if they come back seasonally, though?
No, it didn't matter. I mean, that's your choice.
To help the family, yeah.
If you've got a residency in Chivac and you hang out in Anchorage part of the year, fine, you're still a Chivacer. But if you've moved to Anchorage, that's what your license says, that's what your voter says.
That's where your kids go to school.
That's where you're at, then you're, you know. I mean, I live in Gustavus during the summer. I can't use a shark card to go halibut fishing. I got to put a line out there and catch nothing while all the locals out there use shark cards. And, you know, that's the way it is. If I became a Gustavus resident, I could get a shark card.
So this is really interesting to me that that this topic, context did it come up?
I think just the issue of, because people who, how did it come up? I think it probably came up because Alaska Natives who lived in Anchorage weren't happy about it all. And that was part of why I wasn't interested in having Bethel studied, because, you know, Bethel is more like Anchorage than it is like GVAC.
Well, you live there. I wouldn't know. But I would also say, I don't know about Bethel, but if we shift it to Dillingham or Kotzebue, I'd say that Dillingham is more like New Stuyahok than it is like Anchorage.
Yeah, well, I mean... But it's on the edge.
Yeah.
I mean,
Bethel was definitely
on the edge. You know, it was 60-40 native or closer to 50-50 when I was living there.
Yeah.
You know, grocery stores, you know, all kinds of issues that, you know, you could have gone either way. You know, you weren't in charge of the decision, better not to even let it come up.
Yeah, but of course in the legislative history of Anilka, when somebody, I don't know who it was, rattled off examples of urban and rural places, Bethel wound up in the rural list.
And
that was important that they picked those regional centers rather than the villages as examples of...
Right, but I mean, like Sitka's out in and Ketchikan's out, you know.
Well, no, Ketchikan is back in.
Well, but maybe now, cited as the four.
Yeah.
It was Fairbanks, Anchorage, Juneau, and Ketchikan were the four.
Yeah.
I mean...
As urban areas?
As urban areas.
Those were the only four.
That were named.
And it was like Ketchikan. You know, it really probably wasn't right, but that's how Ketchikan was viewed in those days.
And it didn't name the Kenai Peninsula.
No.
No, but those were just examples. And so, you know, we had to deal with this. This was post-repeal initiative that one of our biggest... our biggest assignments was to figure out how to distinguish urban from rural, and that then wound up with the Kenaitse decision that Larry and I were talking about at lunchtime, and then the debates that our joint board had over it, and then that the Federal Subsistence Board continues to deal with.
And this wasn't something in the early days, Norm, that you were dealing with, was an urban-rural definition? Was that being...
Oh, yeah, that was a big part of this whole thing, was what's urban, what's rural? If it's going to be a rural priority, you got to figure out what's rural. Now, the Subsistence Division went through a whole rigmarole in trying to come up with criteria and all this stuff.
And we did.
And you did, and
yeah,
so
you're
fine. I mean, I sort of, like, watched it, that they were doing it, but it was their deal, and... You know, good, better them than me to worry about that. But and then you go to the board and you explain it all, and you know, all that stuff went on.
And this point
I
about
sort of can remember in the back of my mind
about, you know, people who moved to Anchorage and then go back. Was that written into the 78 law?
The deal was sort of like, it says rural. What does that mean? And if you're a rural resident, you're a rural resident. I mean, then Marine Mammal Protection Act says coastal native person, you know, if you live in Are you in the coast in Anchorage? Well, maybe, no. Maybe not. But certainly if you're in Fairbanks, you don't qualify
right.
to go beluga hunting in Cook Inlet.
But yeah, I was wondering if it's written in, it's in the 78
no.
law,
no.
or it's under implementation
yeah.
regulation.
Well,
not the 78 law. The 78 law had no rural preference either. It was done by regulation.
Okay.
And that's what the Madison decision, and why we had the 86 law. The 86 law had the rural language in there, but and it had a definition of what a rural place is, and then there was a set of criteria that Norm is referring to that I think was originally adopted by regulation by the Joint Board as to how to identify those non-rural places. And that's why the Kenai, as I say, those other
right.
places were just the examples, and it's why it's so important that the federal examples, and we were trying to comply with federal law in 86,
right.
why the regional centers were named as examples of rural places and not villages. Yeah, that's what we could look at. And we did a whole report on regional
right.
centers and their characteristics, but we didn't have any quantified information for Bethel. We only did that much, much later. But we did have Kotzebue, we did have Dillingham. We had Sitka, too, I think.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Sitka's got a lot of use over there.
Plus, you know, the Tlingits there are pretty savvy politically.
Yeah.
They know how to make a
right.
make,
yeah.
make a point. yeah. So.
Right, they were, yeah, I mean, there's a big Native population
yeah.
in Sitka.
Well, as you were just talking about that example of people coming back to the village, and I'm just wondering in what context, because we didn't really get that.
It was just like, this isn't fair, you know,
yeah.
you're not letting me participate or whatever, and it was, you know, when you have to pick and choose, you have to pick and choose. And
yeah. It is kind of an interesting topic to look at retrospectively, and this came up yesterday in a staff meeting and with the division staff, we were going over study findings for the four Chinook communities, the Chinook Bay, Lagoon, Lake, and Perryville. Okay, I'm losing my train of thought here. Oh, and Chinook Bay has gone from 150 people 20 years ago to 50 now, who are living there year round. The school is closed and so forth. However, there's like 100 people who are former Chinook Bay people who go back there in the summertime to fish, and they also engage in subsistence fishing and some other activities, clam and so forth. So the community of Chinook Bay is somewhat criticizing our work right now, saying that the only people you're interviewing to characterize our community are the people that live here year round. You should also be talking with these seasonal people. And I guess, I wasn't there, but I guess at least some of them were saying, you should include this in part of our community pattern. So this becomes really different from, because what you were saying earlier about this view that there was this view that people who have committed to living in cities, you know, that's their choice. That's what I heard too. People in Tyonek would say that all the time. Tyonek people who live in Anchorage, you know, that's they have all these other things that they can do. But now it sounds like for some communities where so many people have moved in urban, that might be changing.
This state has changed so much since I've been here in 50 years. So much. I mean, you wouldn't even recognize socially how it's different than it was then. You know, we're just coming into the period in the mid-70s where people were hiding that they were Native until the Claims Act came around and empowered people. And it wasn't until, 89 or 90 that tribes were, whether they were correctly or incorrectly,
recognized,
and that's where Don will say they weren't, but that's sort of his business, that, you know, that. And now we're, in my uninformed but view, is that basically, except for oil and mining companies, this state is economically, it's all the native corporations, whether it's the whether it's tribes, whether it's health corporations, or regional and village corporations. They are the economics of this state right now. And that's how I see the world these days. And so this is, I do tours at the Capitol when I'm in town, and that's part of my spiel is how, you know, in 1945, when, what's her name, Paratrovich, made the speech at the legislature, she couldn't even go into the Baranoff because she was Native. And it wasn't until the bill passed that she was able to go there with her husband and dance. This was a tough town. And now, you know, it's basically Native corporations run the place, whether it's Gold Belt or Huda Totem or Sea Alaska or Search. This is like a whole different place. The whole state's different. I don't think it's universally recognized as that's what's going on here, but at least that's my view as to how things have changed. So there's nothing like it was. And certainly if you're a Native person from Chinook Bay, I assume these folks are
Native people,
folks. Yeah. You know, the attitude that there may have been about rural in 1978 or 1986 is a total different view as to how people should be treated today. And, you know, time has changed more than the law has changed, and attitudes have changed. That's my view of Alaska in a nutshell. For what it's worth, not much.
One of the things I've been thinking about a little bit with this project is the term subsistence.
Yes.
That now there is some feeling that is not...
That's been going on for the last 40 years. The same... I mean, maybe it's going on now. I don't pay attention. But, yeah, fine.
So where do you know how the term subsistence...
Because that's what everybody said was going on in the 70s. And probably before that. That's how people talked about it. And then they put customary and traditional on as a way of describing it. But that was the term. And then people said, it's a lifestyle. Well, it's not a lifestyle. It's a way of life. You know, I mean, people talk about lifestyle at the time. And then subsistence, that really doesn't. And then rural, it should be Native. I mean, people fight over these words. I'm fine.
One of the I've heard the criticism is that the term subsistence implies, you know, barely eking out a living.
If you want to criticize, you can find fault with everything. So this is something that people want to find fault with. Fine, it's their deal. It's still subsistence to me. If you want to call it something else and they change the name, fine, I'll call it that. I don't care.
What the heck else are you going to call
it? But in the 70s when you were working, it was just, you don't know that anybody came up with the term.
No, it was the term that had been used.
Okay.
Yeah, but you brought up something that we really haven't discussed, this idea that subsistence is customary and traditional. Do you know where that phrase came from?
I thought this was all part of Hinman's deal in that case. But I don't know for sure where it came from.
Well, that would be interesting if Bob Hinman is the guy that came up with customary and traditional.
But you should find out where it did actually came from. I don't know. Don would know.
It wasn't Tom Lawner?
No, because it was in the law.
Lawner's post-law. It was in the state law.
But it was in the NILCA first.
Oh, as a draft?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure it was.
Yeah, because that's really important, because it's the way you can respond to these assertions that subsistence means or implies or results in the view that it's just bare bones existence. And then sometimes when I've asked, what do you want to use instead? And somebody will say, well, traditional use.
Yeah.
Well, do you know how subsistence is defined in the law? No. Customary traditional use.
Right.
And have you ever seen the 8 criteria that talks about sharing, that talks about traditional values, that talks about wide use of resources, and it's all a way of life. It doesn't talk about whether you're going to starve or not.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and right. It's just somebody just doesn't like the word, or there's a group. I mean, that's been around for a long time. Yeah. People have been yapping about it, and I'll say, fine, go ahead. Yeah. I don't, you know, whatever.
So the 78 law came about because they were drafting Anilka?
Yes.
Before that, okay.
And they were told, do this or you're going to lose management.
Okay.
Yeah.
And nobody wanted that to happen at the time. I mean, there were some probably who didn't, but most people didn't want to do that, though they had done it for marine mammals and, you know, just a couple of years earlier. So it's not like it wasn't, there was a model there, and that was a native model. And then Stevens decided that there wasn't going to be a native model anymore. And how that decision got made and who was involved in it, I don't know. But they, basically, they had that model, and then they just changed it.
Yeah. Out of the Anilka.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the break.
Yeah.
Between the two was...
Well, as I understand it, Hammond, Governor Hammond, either he testified or he had somebody testify for him, or he submitted something that basically made that argument to shift from Alaska Native preference to a rural preference, mm-hmm. so the state could keep management, because the state could not do a Native preference under the Constitution, but at the time it was believed could do a rural preference, which turned out to be not true either,
mm-hmm.
at least in the opinion of four of the five justices. Yeah.
Well, they get to decide.
Yeah, it's interesting to read Rabinowitz's dissent in that case, because in my view, he got it right.
Yeah, I don't remember it at this point.
Yeah, well, part of the...
Do we have that Rabinowitz dissent somewhere in the files, Karen or Jim?
I'm not aware of it.
I've probably got it somewhere in a box. It's probably easily accessed.
Online somewhere.
Yeah, the McDowell decision itself and the Rabinowitz dissent. Yeah, because one of the arguments that... Who was the justice that wrote?
Matthews.
I mean, there's this argument that the rural preference created a closed class, right? That it limited eligibility to certain people and nobody else could get in there. And that's just silly. Anybody can move to rural Alaska. And Matthews actually addressed this, because it was brought up by Larry Spengler probably and some others, that, well, no, there's nothing that says you can't live in rural Alaska, and so it's not a closed class. And I think Matthews said, well, there's limited resources and jobs in rural Alaska, so people aren't going to move. That's exactly the point, right? That's exactly the point. And Rabinowitz addressed that.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Yeah, as I recall.
Yeah, well, that's good, because I forget.
So once you were with Fish and Game,
yeah,
did subsistence come across your radar?
Somewhat, but not that much. I was sort of in this, I remember there were a few times when an issue would come up that I would get involved with. I remember having it out with Lou Pamplin about something or other.
He was wildlife division.
Yeah, Lou was a good guy and a right-thinking guy, and did a fantastic job on the goose management plan out there, and how he went to Bethel and described to everybody the problem that there is with these birds, and we got to work together. You know, sort of like Jim Reardon's letter in '64, except this was sort of more sincere, I think.
Yeah.
And
he meant it. Yeah.
And the Fed and the state didn't really have a role in managing that much with, you know, birds, migratory birds. But he did a really good job with that and got to people and they understood and went along pretty well with what the program was. And now I guess they're back hunting them again, aren't they? Or those all recovered, those four species? So it worked, and so anyways, there was one issue, I forget what it was, but I knew I waited on that one, and maybe a couple others, but I, for the most part, was just trying to manage divisions. to the extent that deputy commissioners have any control over anything anyways.
Mm.
And I did a lot of work with the fish treaties and other stuff like that.
Were you Steve's our director's supervisor, or was he supervised directly by the commissioner?
No, I was
okay.
The supervisor of all the divisions.
Oh.
I mean, Warren Wiley.
Oh, I remember.
Remember
him.
Warren Wiley?
Yes, I do.
He's still around. He beats me. Yeah, no, he's still Clark Greening died. He wrote a note about that. So that was sort of like, woo, Warren Wiley. I haven't heard his name for a while. But he was sort of worthless. And so I'd ended up being me who did the supervision, you know, did their performance reviews and stuff of all the division.
So you're saying when Steve Behnke was division director?
Was he the director when I was there?
Yeah. No, he was director from 83 till 90 or 91.
So he was, yeah. I guess, the director.
I don't remember this stuff.
Yeah.
So, Bill, do you have any other questions?
You don't have to.
No, I really don't. My head is kind of spinning because I'm trying to reconcile this whole discussion of rural versus urban and what the role of the subsistence division is in terms of understanding subsistence at a statewide level and coming to grips with the various differences between communities and movements in and out of communities that you've talked about today. And so I guess I'll just keep spinning unless someone wants to add a cap to that.
I think it is all very confusing. That's the whole why it's still an issue, maybe.
Well, quite frankly, I don't think it's confusing, having played a role in trying to straighten it all out. You know, I mean, this should be in my interview, really, not in Norm's, but, you know, I think back to when we were tasked with helping the joint board and the individual boards make that distinction between rural places and urban places. We took that really seriously, and we did directed studies. We looked into definitions of those terms, because it was alleged that they're simple. They're not simple. Every agency that uses those terms defines them differently, mm-hmm. and looks at different ways of measuring them. And so we said, you know, for the joint board, you come up with what you think makes sense regarding this. And we came up with something that wound up in the 86 law as a definition. It survived into the 92 law as a definition of a non-subsistence area. There's a list of 12 things that you look at to try to make these distinctions.
Yes.
But it's still a balancing act. It's not as if it's all black and white. There's plenty of gray areas, but you know, it was taken seriously.
I certainly didn't mean to say you didn't take it seriously. What I was getting at was this whole complexity of understanding where subsistence is today, mm. and in terms of rural Alaska, and that's a really complicated question.
Well, yeah, it is, and it goes back to something that Norm was talking about, where you don't see a lot of these topics in the paper very much, and that's because the state law and a lot of I'm not the guy being interviewed here, but the state law in a lot of ways is dysfunctional in terms of providing for subsistence in places where there really are issues, such as the Copper Basin.
I'm wondering too if the joint management system that now the feds are more involved in managing subsistence.
Yeah, but that's been like 40 years or 35 years since.
It's been a long time. Yeah, who would have thought that, right?
Who knows? I mean,
we thought it was going to be a year or so.
So, does the federal system work better?
Well, I think rural people would say yes to that.
Yeah. I mean, as what I said before is, you got a bunch of people who don't really care about urban hunters or other people.
Or they're, commercial activities.
Right, because, you know, they're there for, you know, maybe the BLM person cares a little bit, but the rest of them, you know, their loyalties, their preferences are going to be these people as opposed to boards that have a different constituency. And so, sure, you're going to like them better. And plus, they deal, they like to deal with folks as natives as, instead of just folks as rural, even if they can't do it under the law. That's sort of their, they fed, just, you know, the state has never been viewed by rural Alaska as their friend. And,
well, Jim, do you, is, are there things that we should ask Norm before we conclude this?
Well, I've been looking over my, my list here, and I think I raised everything on here. There were some things that, that Norm was not involved in that I wanted to talk about if he had been, but we got that clarified. I guess one thing to follow up on that you said earlier, you really thought Tom Lonner did a good job.
Yeah.
But do you remember specifically what, no, what it was about? What
I had a very positive impression of the efforts that were made to make a professional outfit that would do good work, you know, and, you know, so it hires people who are, I mean, who are credentialed in their field, and, you know, so they, you know, in fish and game, you've got a whole bunch of biologists who are, you know, have some credentials, and so they carry some weight, and, you know, you have to have weight on your side, too, and I thought that built a really good program, and so I always felt good about it. But, you know, to start from zero and to have to build it under, needless to say, trying and circumstances in a place that nobody wants you, that's a, you know, that's an accomplishment. Mm-hmm. So a legacy.
Did you work with him directly at all?
Well, a little bit, but, you know, it wasn't, you know, what sort of watching what he did. I met him with him a couple of times, but what, he would be hired in 87?
Oh, no, no.
79.
He was hired in February of 79, and he left in February of 81.
Right, so that was 2 years.
2 years.
And during that period of time, 79, I worked for Rural Cap, and then I, in 81, I worked at the legislature for Tony Vasca, as in Alaska. And yeah, so anyways, another dead person.
Because it comes out in the, especially the later articles that he wrote.
Tom?
That Tom wrote, that, I mean, he's, the struggle that he had in developing the program and implementing the state law in a way that he thought was fair and necessary, it just comes out very loudly in you know, what he wrote, and in retrospect it seemed like he was somewhat disillusioned by the whole thing. Some of his testimony to the Berger Commission comes out that any step that Native communities took towards Western management was a step in the wrong direction. And
well, you know, that's, you know, we always felt that legal services, you know, we're here to protect you, or, you know, to represent you, help you out, but we're really bringing Western systems to on top of you. And you know, I mean, it's sort of, you know, there's sort of a mixed bag there, needless to say. And, you know, Tom became a true believer, I guess, so the more power to him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was there and then he wasn't.
Yeah, and he had to fight some major battles, I know, because one thing that, and I want to talk to Steve about this, but what some people within the department told me when I first started working for the division is that what they thought the division would largely do was to monitor harvests, that the permit systems, especially on the fish side, that Comfish for the most part, Sportfish for a little did, that all of that would be handed over to the division and they wouldn't have to deal with it anymore. And that would be largely what we did.
Right.
And Lahner basically said no to that.
Mm-hmm.
And he developed this research strategy that focused on subsistence as an economic system, subsistence as a way of life. He very clearly criticized this idea of lifestyle. And even though others pro-subsistence sometimes use that term. So, and he successfully did that.
And
it's interesting to hear that, you know, people who were then observers saw that and saw that this was an incredible accomplishment.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a few people pull things out like that, and it's very impressive. Anyways, I hope that my history is correct. You know, you put some holes in it, and it may not be, which is fine. You know, I don't want to give you misleading information, but you've got my memory. That's what oral projects are about.
Yeah,
and
right.
We're talking 45 years ago, so I'm entitled to a few.
And the fact
hiccups.
You were quote in the room, and some of that.
I was
helps.
In that room, yeah. And I'm convinced that that is correct on when this idea of a subsistence entity showed up, but yeah. That's...
I have sort of a wrap-up question, which we were talking legacy.
Yeah.
Legacy of subsistence research and your thoughts about the legacy of the fact that we have a subsistence law and a subsistence division with all the work you've done. Any thoughts about that as a legacy?
Not for me, not my legacy.
No,
for the state, I guess.
The state.
Resources. Yeah, your views on the fact that the subsistence division has done all this research and done all this work, what that legacy has meant in the state.
I think there's been, as I went on and on about the change in the state over time, I think that this is a, you know, just one of those pieces of trying to, you know, it's a weird state in many ways. And, you know, people who've lived here and then people who came and people who know what's been happened over time and people who just showed up and think that this is just like anywhere else. And, you know, but it has changed a lot. And this issue, which is, you know, pretty central to what rural Alaska has been about, the kind of emphasis and resources that have gone into figuring it out, you know, it's changed how people view use of resources in the state. You know, my son-in-law who will go hunting probably doesn't know anything about any of this stuff, and as long as he can do that, you know, things are good. But, you know, that's, but it is what it is now because a lot of it is the work that was done. So I think it's been a big, played a large role, and I had no idea that that was possible in the late 70s.
All right, thank you.
That was positive, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you can add negative. If there had been not a positive legacy.
Well, buried somewhere in our questions was something to the effect that were there opportunities or that in retrospect the division missed?
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
I thought that's what you were going to say.
No,
which is
I have no, yeah. Yeah.
Or that they didn't, you know, you were there in the room and then none of that has played out the way you had envisioned.
No, I had no grand vision for how things were going to go. Just did what Harold told me to do, that's all.
Well, okay, so Bill, anything else?
No, thanks for the opportunity, Norm.
Hey, very good. And
Unless, Norm, you have anything else?
Nope, I'm done.
Goodbye, Bill.
Thanks, everyone.
Okay.
Thanks, bye.